I'm back in Singapore, and I'm sitting in an outdoor cafe, a little place called the 6-Ounce Espresso Bar. I'm not sure if they only serve by 6 ounces, but I'll get a coffee in just a minute. But before that, I want to tell you a little bit about my next meeting. It's with a gentleman by the name of Asad Razouk, founder and CEO of Syndicatum Sustainable Resources. Fascinating character, born in Beirut, lived in London, investment banker, and a dedicated and committed individual to the cause of clean energy and clean tech. He's recently been named as the top 50 low carbon pioneers by CNBC, and he's also chosen by INSEAD as among the world's 20 most influential members on Twitter. Which is interesting, 20 most influential. We're gonna find out what he tweets about, what he thinks about, so stay tuned, and we'll be meeting Asad Razouk shortly. I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. Let's get right to my conversation with clean energy investor and commentator Asad Razouk. He's Group Chief Executive and co-founder of Syndicatum Sustainable Resources, headquartered here in Singapore. I started off by asking him, as I often do, about how he made his way to Asia.
I was born and bred in Lebanon. I then, because of the Civil War, finished my education in the United States before starting to work in New York for 5 years and then subsequently moving to London, where... I was in corporate finance, right, advising corporates pretty much worldwide at the end on mostly capital raisings and
you got around.
Yes. That was, we had a team in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Sydney, Paris, London, and New York, and we saw a lot of flow. I then left in 2002 to start my own thing, as one does. While still in the corporate finance business, around 2003 and 2004, me and a bunch of colleagues picked up on the fact that Japanese corporates were running around the stands, Central Asia, trying to pick up pollution rights for entire cities.
As a novelty, or they saw a business? I mean, this was before the carbon credits or anything else that came from this. It's early days.
Yeah, this was very early days. We did not understand any of that, right? So it piqued our interest that they were trying to buy, the pollution rights of an entire city.
Explain that. What does that mean to purchase the pollution rights?
What that means is that if you go to the mayor of the city, you tell the mayor that you think that the city emits so much carbon and methane emissions per year from various activities, including energy, transportation, waste management, buildings and what have you. You then estimate that flow of pollution, in effect, right, of greenhouse gases, and you buy the right to monetize them. Now, you can monetize greenhouse gases in several different ways. For example, methane can be captured and turned into electricity. CO2, however, is mostly monetized by producing a piece of paper that says that instead of allowing it to go into the atmosphere, you have stopped it being emitted through a capture mechanism, and therefore you've earned a piece of paper that says that you've stopped a ton of CO2 from going into the atmosphere.
The Japanese were pioneers in this space. They were preparing them to go back to their home market, create a bourse for this, and trade these carbon credits within Japan, or do they have a global plan?
Well, to this day, to be honest, I wasn't sure what they were doing. I don't think they did either. So I do know, however, that they didn't end up doing much with it, the Japanese themselves. Mm-hmm. However, at about the same time, as we looked into the space, we discovered two things. The first one was the European Union was introducing its own carbon market. Mm-hmm. Again, putting a limit on the pollution of industrial installations, so how much they can emit, and then allowing them to effectively trade excesses and savings and replace that and use carbon credits to offset their pollution.
Now, where is that traded? I mean, again, for listeners who may not be familiar with this, because it was there prior to the global financial crisis, and then this concept faded away for several years. So some people may not be entirely familiar with how this works. What happened between 2003, 2004, and up to the global financial crisis? And were these credits actually traded? Was there a market for it? And how robust was that market?
Yeah, good question, Steve. A lot happened between 2003 and 2008. First, the European Union created the biggest carbon market in the world, which trialed during those years and then went live in 2005. At the same time, the United Nations, under United Nations auspices, a protocol that was negotiated back in 97, but required a certain number of minimum countries to ratify it in order to become effective, became also effective in 2005, in February 2005, and it was called the Kyoto Protocol. That created yet another carbon market, which was of a more global nature, that talked to the European carbon market in the sense that securities could travel between them. About the same time, California, for example, started looking at creating its own. And there was quite a bit of action in the U.S. Congress, again, around the same time, in terms of introducing various carbon market mechanisms. And, you know, this hasn't stopped in the United States. Only yesterday, Janet Yellen published an op-ed in the Financial Times, pushing again that very same idea from 2003-2008.
A conservative and somebody who not, wouldn't necessarily you would expect to back something like this.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. We started the business at the time in 2005 that was focused on building operations in China, India, Indonesia, Thailand, and elsewhere. That did exactly that. So we wanted to capture greenhouse gases and then turn them into something useful, electricity or other form of commodities, and carbon credits.
And how did that go for a while? I mean, my recollection is that people were on, they saw momentum and they were prepared to do this. And then you saw a lot of activity around that time. Were you finding, it sounds like you caught that wave relatively early.
Look, the private sector engaged, and it engaged because a cap and trade system is in effect designed for the private sector with incentives and punishments that they understood, right, under a stable regulatory framework. So the private sector engaged during that time. A lot of startups were created. There was a lot of innocence and enthusiasm. Then reality interfered mostly in two big ways. The first, the first way reality interfered is by effectively politicians who are on, you know, short election cycles that cannot capture the climate change as a problem within that, 3 to 5 years that they're in power, dropped the ball.
It simply wasn't a priority.
Yeah, they simply dropped the ball. And so the regulatory stability that the private sector was counting on never actually turned up properly. The second thing that happened was the 2008 financial crisis, which really pushed in the same direction. Again, politicians, focused on other things.
Yeah, just rescuing the economy.
Yeah. And then basically, the market, let's say, went away for a few years.
Right.
It's made a comeback since, but we, during the years that it went away, pivoted into renewable energy.
Okay, and explain that. Were these kind of investments in operations, clean energy operations in specific markets, specific sectors?
Yeah, when you are fighting emissions growth, what you want to do is you want to stop a plant from polluting, right? And so we had businesses that went and did, we had a business that went and did exactly that. So we went to, for example, coal mines in China that were in the process of mining coal, emitting methane into the atmosphere. We told them, look, we've got engineering solutions where we can pipe this methane into an engine and produce electricity from it instead of just allowing it to worsen climate change.
Assad, you're a smart guy. You've worked the world. You've been with all kinds of major firms. You have incredible financial credentials. Clean tech and clean energy hasn't necessarily been seen as the most profitable area to get into. A lot of people have been suspicious, as you just rightly pointed out, governments aren't regulating effectively to create the right stability for markets. What is it that drove you to get into this space versus anything else? Property, infrastructure, you name it. There could have been 20 others. What is that that drove you into this?
We pivoted into renewable energy by taking the renewable energy assets that we had because we were producing electricity from waste products, okay, in effect, and then developed a renewable energy business around that. Now, along the way, and it's a very good question, because obviously I started really from a curiosity perspective, then because of a business opportunity, let's save the world and make some money. However, as my experience grew in the sector, I became much more passionate and much more committed to renewables and clean tech and climate finance and sustainability, because the one thing Asia gives you that perhaps Northern Europe or the United States don't is that you actually see the suffering caused by climate change in real time.
Whether it's the island nation of the Maldives or the industrial wastelands of China.
Yes, exactly. It's not that complicated. You just go to a random city in China, which is dependent on a lot of coal, and you just look at people's teeth.
This is Inside Asia. I've been speaking with clean energy entrepreneur, investor, and commentator Assad Razouk. More in a moment. This is Steve Stein, and I'm speaking with Assad Razouk, Group Chief Executive and co-founder of Syndicatum Sustainable Resources, a global clean energy investment firm headquartered in Singapore. In the second part of our conversation, I asked Assad about China, which is both one of the world's largest producers and one of the leading innovators in clean tech solutions. I asked him what happened, why China, and why now?
China had a particular path that it followed to get to this, to where it is today in terms of clean energy. And what it was is that they woke up 5 years ago and said, you know what? We've become the dumping grounds for the entire world in terms of pollution and health problems.
That's how they saw it, the dumping ground.
Yes.
As if it were done to them or as if they did it to themselves.
It doesn't really matter. The point is you have a communist regime that at the end of the day feels, rightly so, that its legitimacy goes through not, harming its own population.
Yeah.
And so when the population started waking up every day to polluted skies, dirty water, rising contingent healthcare liabilities, and it destroyed really landscape and countryside, as well as polluted cities and asthma crisis and what have you, the Chinese did what they do best. They took a look at it top down and they introduced a 5-year plan that was massively aggressive in trying to turn the situation around. And then that led to an incredibly rapid growth in the installation of renewable energy across the nation, as well as the electrification of, for example, the transportation sector. And the second five-year plan that followed that now, and that we're in the midst of, has taken that again to stratospheric levels. And China is big enough that what it did drove the cost structure of renewable energy everywhere else in the world.
And down. And unlike, you know, there have been struggles for multinationals and others trying to do business in China, given that clean energy, renewable, environmental management has now become a greater priority for China, has that opened opportunities for international investors that perhaps isn't necessarily the case in other sectors, or is it still complicated and frustrating?
Have you ever done business in West Virginia?
Not yet. No. Have you?
We have. Okay. Yeah. We've done business in West Virginia and Pennsylvania. And Steve, believe me, China is a walk in the park comparatively.
I love that. Can you give me an example? Because of, I mean, this West Virginia love of coal, like it's, it goes deeper in West Virginia than it does in China? Or is it just that the feeling that we need to do something about this is more eminent and more real in the eyes of the Chinese than it is the West Virginians?
I just simply don't look at business in that way. When you do, so we today, you know, we're a small company, but we still have operations in China, India, Thailand, Indonesia, the Philippines, and Singapore. In every country that we're in, we are extremely local, you know, and we're not really a foreign company.
And when you say that, you mean you just work closely with local partners and you come in with the insights, the structures, the financing to support what they feel needs and should be done?
Not quite. You've expressed it the way kind of a foreign investor might.
Yeah, please help me understand.
No, I think you have to go into the country. You have to go into Indonesia and set up your office as an Indonesian, not as a foreign investor. Mm-hmm. And you have to look at the country with local eyes. And you have to hire local talent. And you have to effectively integrate the community. That is the typical challenge with doing business. And that's why I said, you know, West Virginia, frankly, is probably more difficult if you look at it from that past perspective. Mm-hmm. I think we've been probably accepted as locals easier in China than in West Virginia.
So give us an example of what you've been able to do by virtue of that business approach.
Well, look, we the entire global renewable energy industry is still very small, right? And so I think, you know, at the moment, what's clear is that we have to rebuild Asia's entire infrastructure to make sure lifestyles are fueled with clean energy. And frankly, I think collectively, we still haven't done much, and there's a lot more to be done.
But by virtue of the fact that there are not as many people involved in the sector and in this industry as need to be involved. Is that what you mean?
Partly, and partly because oil, gas, and coal remain massively subsidized, yet have succeeded through, you know, old style propaganda techniques to convince your typical reader or citizen that it's renewable energy that's subsidized. It's clean tech that's subsidized. Mm-hmm. When in fact, the data is, you know, the absolute opposite. And I think the ratio is like 10 to 1 in terms of subsidies, i.e. oil, gas and coal are subsidized 10 times more than renewables.
Across the world, or is this an Asia phenomenon?
That's an average across the world, but it's worse in Asia.
Much oil prices worse. In Indonesia, for instance.
For instance, yeah, much worse. Everything really. I mean, have you ever asked yourself why there are no electric cars in Singapore?
Yeah, vested interest in, you know, the existing automobile industry, I suspect. I don't know.
Yeah, and why this insistence that we can't build a big solar power plant in Singapore or, you know, come up with offshore wind solutions? This is Singapore. We're talking a first world country that's leading by example in Southeast Asia and effectively giving the wrong example.
Well, why is that? Can you, because, I mean, that's been a mystery to me. I've been here 17, 18 years, and I'm constantly wondering. I mean, this is probably the best single city on earth for electric cars, if you think about it. It's small, it's flat, the infrastructure is second to none, and you've got a gas station on every corner that could be converted immediately to refuel with electric, couldn't you?
The answer is always the same, and it's the same in Indonesia. It's the same in every single country that I think you can think of. Oil, gas, and coal and their derivatives have been providing jobs and creating value for over 150 years.
Yeah.
And they've built intricate links with societies, you know, through that activities, and they've built enormous wealth.
It's part
and
of
money talks,
yeah,
Steve.
Yeah, part of the economic fabric. It's hard to tear that out.
Yes. So you need leadership to get over that. Look at California. Yesterday, California enacted a law which ensures that California will be 100% powered by renewables by 2045.
Yeah.
It's the fifth largest economy in the world. If California can do it, everybody else can do it.
Yeah.
But you've got to rise above vested interests, fossil fuel lobbies, deceiving arguments about jobs, because we create a lot more jobs. We, renewable energy, create a lot more jobs than fossil fuels.
A lot of people don't know that, but that keeps coming up.
That's right. Mm. And that's exactly right. And you have to have leadership.
Well, that brings me to the prognosis question, you know, looking, spanning and panning across the region and looking market to market, considering the infrastructure, what exists in terms of energy today. What's your hope and expectation for the introduction of clean tech in Asia Pacific to the point where it could lead the world versus follow the world?
It's game over for fossil fuels.
Wow, that's definitive. So that's it. Day is done.
Yes, yes. It's going to take a decade or 15 years to play out. But the fact of the matter is that today we are cheaper, cleaner, better, and we create more jobs, i.e. we can deliver electricity cheaper than any other source. We create more jobs, right?
Yeah.
We also do not create any pollution and aren't killing citizens. And therefore, all it's going to take is for this to literally trickle down as we keep attracting more and more capital into this space.
I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. You've been listening to my conversation with Asad Razouk, clean energy investor, thought leader, and group chief executive and co-founder of Syndicatum Sustainable Resources. This brings us to the Asia Insider Minute portion of the program, where I try to distill some key themes and flesh out a few questions around the conversation you've just heard. On the day I met with Asad in Singapore, Governor Jerry Brown was on the other side of the world and about to announce plans to make his state of California carbon neutral by the year 2045. There's nothing binding about this decision, and it's unlikely that Jerry will still be governor 28 years from now, but it's a statement nevertheless, and one of the biggest that any government of any size has made since the whole climate change debate erupted several years back. To put this into perspective, California today is the fifth largest economy in the world. With its big cities, large populations, and booming industries, it's also one of the biggest consumers of electricity in the country. Perhaps because of this, the state government has made sustainable energy a leading priority for years now. So much so that in 2016, California ranked second among all 50 states in combined electricity generation from all forms of renewable energy. That's a big achievement in a relatively short period of time. But why am I telling you all this? We're supposed to be inside Asia. It's because Asia has its own California, and it goes by the name of China. What China does or doesn't do, in other words, has major repercussions for the rest of the region. Carbon has made a precipitous climb over 25 years, earning China the dubious title of world's biggest polluter. Annually, it emits 10.4 billion metric tons of the stuff, or about 30% of the world's total. If that's the price one pays to become the world's largest manufacturing base, the Grim Reaper is on the move and looking for payback. More than 6 million Chinese die annually from pollution-related diseases, and analysts predict that as the population ages, these numbers are bound to grow. Still, there's hope. China knows it has a problem, and it isn't resting on its laurels when it comes to tackling pollution. Already, it leads the world in solar and wind power, and plans are in place to do much, much more. There's also signs that carbon levels are peaking. Now it's game on to reduce those levels on pace with California's own progress in recent years. To that end, Governor Brown is looking to partner with China. Last year, he signed a wave of clean tech cooperation agreements, and today, scores of technical and design exchanges are underway. But is it too little too late? As our guest Asad Razouk points out, the need for clean energy throughout Asia is not an abstract notion. There's an urgency to the situation, and everybody knows it. We don't have to imagine it anymore. It's here. Pay a trip to China's Hebei province and witness an environmental calamity in the making. Shaking people out of their comfort zones and getting them to own a long-term solution is never easy. But says Asad, what choice do we have? If you don't have the answer for that, and if you haven't found yourself asking it, then you know the shape of the problem we're facing. Thanks for listening, and until next week, I'm Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia.